We are in an interview with Winona Daggett in her apartment in the Cedars Towers on the 4th of May, 1978. Now, Winona, we'd be glad for you to develop anything that you'd care to about your family background and about John's family background. We may ask you questions occasionally.
Well, I know, of course, a lot more about my own family background than I do John's. But my mother was Phoebe France McGaffey, and she came to Nebraska from Ohio when she was about 8 years old. Her mother was Fanny Shell, and I think her father's name was Jacob France, but I'm not really sure about that. And my father was Frank McGaffey, and he came from, lived in Nebraska, but he had been in Illinois, I think, as a boy.
Do you know where in Illinois?
No, I don't think I could say for sure. My mother's people were around Girard for a while, and I think that he was in that area, too.
Shut that off a minute.
Well, I see my father's family lives in New Hampshire. I remember when they came over, they were here in the time of the Revolutionary War. We have a picture of a farm up there where the McCleary House, they call it, where they stationed soldiers. And this McCleary girl was married to a McGaffey. So they were here quite early. And then John's family, they'd say there were three brothers that came over in 1630, I think it was, with Governor Brewster in Massachusetts. And they scattered. They were had a letter some time ago from somebody in Texas. There's a woman in Franklin, Texas, married to a Walter Daggett. And but the Daggett history, I don't know very much about, really. That,
How about John's immediate family? How many brothers and
sisters? Well, he had one brother and two sisters, Rufus, Mary, and Martha. Martha Horning and Mary Brandt. They all passed away except Rufus, and he lives in Independence, Kansas.
Now, Mary Brandt.
Yes, Mrs.
She was married to H. A. Brandt.
Mrs. Oh, they are Mrs.
Harry Brandt.
Mrs. Harry Brandt. Yes, I know. Mm-hmm. Well, we ought to get your family in this too. The rest of the McGaffeys. Why don't we run through them in order so we get them on the tape?
All my sisters, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And well, who they married?
The oldest one was Irma, married Miles Blickenstaff. They both died, and they were living in Seattle at the time of their death. And Edith, they're married to John D. Bright, and he died a few years ago, and she's still living in Topeka, the Brewster place. And my brother Will has been gone about 15 or 20 years, I think. His home was in Florida at the time of his death. And he married Mary Toms of Polo, Illinois. And I think I come next. Married John Daggett in 1924. And Fanny married Henry Stover and lived around Kansas most of the time. And Maxine to Foster Hoover in Kansas City. Laura to Fred A. Clarenbach. They've been at Madison, Wisconsin, most of their married life. And Nellie to Glenn Strickler, living at Hayes. And Walter, my youngest brother, was not married and died a little more than a year ago. And I don't think I missed anybody.
Where did you spend your childhood years?
I grew up in Nebraska at the Holmesville or South Beatrice Church, where we went to church, but we lived 5 miles east of the church, and we're in the Virginia neighborhood there until I was 15.
Did you, folks were farmers there?
Yes. And we went to South Beatrice Church all the time.
Were your parents married at the time they came to Nebraska?
No, they weren't. They were, Grandpa and Grandma lived at near Holmesville, down in that area. And I think it was at that place where they were married.
Now, you're which grandparents?
My mother's mother and parents. I think my father came down there and worked for them. That's how they got acquainted. And I don't remember much about it.
That's probably pretty obvious. I suppose nobody preserved much of that social history of the family.
No, not too much. Mother had a half-brother, Ike Ault, and he's been gone a good many years, and all of her sisters, of course, all of them have gone a good many years, but Mother was the youngest of that group, family. And I suppose you get back to my own personal life. We lived on the farm near Lawrence most of our married life.
Now, that's you and John.
Yes, John and me. We had a dairy farm, and lived and went to the Lone Star Church most of the time, until the time of his death.
I've forgotten just how long has it been now. When did he die?
He died in 1962. And then I went out to Abilene and worked at the Brown Memorial Home for 2 years before coming down here to make my home with Walter. And I think that's... You want to know about my children, too?
Yes, we ought to know about your children.
Well, we had two. Bill is in North Manchester, Indiana, an attorney, and Margaret lives at Lee Summit, Missouri, a housewife, substitute teaching. It's teacher summit.
I guess we ought to have the names of their spouses in here, too, just...
Bill is married to Roland Kime, the daughter of Howard Kime, and Margaret's husband is Bill Bigler. His father was John Bigler at Emporia. And his mother's name was Perry, I think.
Is there anything that comes to mind which would pick up the flavor of some of the things you did as kids up in Nebraska?
Nebraska?
What did all of those girls do up there to keep out of trouble? Did you help some with the farm work?
Well, look, I don't remember so much about that. When I think about Nebraska, I think about the South Beatrice Church and the flavor my Aunt Lydia gave to it. And
now that would be Aunt Lydia.
Aunt Lydia France, my mother's older sister, Uncle Dan. And Uncle Alonzo Heaston was married to my mother's sister Mary. And the love feast, and my Aunt Lydia in the kitchen, and my Uncle Lon cooking the beef. And
who were the preachers there at that time? Did they have a free ministry?
Well, yes, James Gish and Jake Dell, and there's a Rife, I think, as I remember, a Rife, right about that. We never knew who was going to preach, of course, but they did, I guess.
Well, now, is that Jacob Dell? Is that your
uncle?
Your mother's uncle? What kinds of preachers were they?
Well, at 15. younger, you don't remember too much. I remember Jake Dell. You know your uncle, what a fierce, heavy eyebrows he had. And of course, at that time, the pulpit was in the front of the church, and you came in facing the audience on either side of the long table. And the young men would stand out on the platform until everything was started, and then they'd all stomp in together and go the full length of the church to the back seat. And if Jake Dell was on the floor, he just stopped stone still and glared at them until they sat down.
Was there pretty good attendance at that church then?
As I remember, yes. I think they had a pretty good crowd. Of course, then I remember the men on one side and the women on the other. And if you dated, and the girls dated, they could come in, the boys could come in on the side where the women sat. But after they got married, that was the end of that. He had to go on the other side of the event.
Would anybody have done much, or is this just custom? You think? Would the church elders have said something, or the deacons or somebody?
I didn't quite get that.
Would the deacons or the elders have actually said something if you had not?
I don't know.
It was that way in my home church, too. I know
yeah,
it happened.
I don't know whether anything would have been said or not, but it was understood that's the way you did. But I remember some couples with small children, the mother would sit on right next to the aisle and the husband on the other, next to the aisle on the other side, and they could kind of work together with taking care of the children. But,
did you use a common communion cup when you were a kid?
Oh, yes. Another thing I remember, too, about one of our young girls when she went to Beatrice to high school and came back to church the first Sunday wearing a little tam o' shanter on her head. She was promptly excommunicated.
Oh? When would that have been?
Well, probably 1908 or 9, maybe, or a little earlier. I think Edith went to high school at Beatrice when she was in 1910. No, she graduated in 1910. So that would have been, I think Ethel was a little older than Edith. So that might have been 1906 or 7, something like that.
Now, you wore conservative dress when you were growing up as a kid.
Oh, yes.
Wear a bonnet?
Yes. I suppose I wore a bonnet till I was 17 or about 20, maybe, or something like that.
Now, when you came to college, all of that stayed home, I suppose.
Yes, as I remember, it did. One thing I noticed about the college, that girls that came there, and you never saw a bonnet on the head all the year they were there, and then I saw them getting packing to go home, and they put on bonnets. They had to wear home.
Was that much of a subject of discussion around the college, the dress business?
I don't
did
think
you,
so.
People talk about
no,
it.
No, I don't think it was.
We've heard this thing that you mentioned from others, that first thing they do when they get to the college would be to go to town and get a new wardrobe mm-hmm. and just not wear that stuff around. And
well, probably some of them did, but
you don't remember really much of anybody wearing that kind of garb when you were in school.
You just didn't see them around college at that time.
Well, I know the annuals we have for some of those years show people with neckties, and I don't think any. Incidentally, let me ask, and she may tie this one in. Do you remember a Sisler girl who was around here? What was her first name? I'm just thinking there's a Sisler whose picture appears in one of those quads. It might have been ahead of you. She was from Richmond, Kansas. Now, I wondered if she was Dave's daughter. Do you remember Dave Sisler?
No, I don't think I do.
When we went to Ottawa a long while ago, he was in the church there, and he was quite elderly then, and had remarried to Allie Ott. And there was a Sisler girl pictured there. She's not living now, I'm sure. And she was from Richmond. That's where Dave lived, and I thought maybe you would have known since you're from up that area. Can't even remember her first name, so it doesn't matter. Did you have musical instruments in the South Beatrice Church?
Oh, no. Definitely not. I don't know when we got musical instruments exactly. We didn't have them up at Buckeye. I went to church up there before. And they didn't have one there then.
Now, when did you go to Buckeye?
Well, that is before I came down here to college.
Why was that?
Well, that is about 1911 through there.
How did you get into Buckeye? Now, let's see.
The folks moved there from Nebraska.
Oh.
So you lived there, what, a couple of years?
In 1919, my older sister, Ermal and Miles, were going to Bethany. And they coax me to go with them. And I did, and I got a place to work in a Catholic home up on Jackson Boulevard, and I worked in my boarding room and went to school. I was there 2 years.
Oh, and that's then, before you came to Memphis.
Yeah, then I came from there down here.
Now, when did your folks move into McPherson?
Oh, about 1920 or something like that.
So you were at Buckeye then for
a number
of years. Do you remember who the ministers were in the Buckeye congregation at that time?
Yes, we had Brillhart was there a while, and Amelia Stewart, and John Cake Rice. There's a name that I remember while I was there. I was gone so much, soon after they left that I...
Now, when you moved to McPherson, did you move at the home where your folks used to live down on Euclid Street, or where did you move when you first came here?
Stephen, I was up, my parents?
Yes.
No, they moved up on North Cary, right there? Pretty well to the north end of Cary.
Oh, that place where J.D. Brights lived once did?
But when I came, Miles and Irma were here keeping house, and I lived with them.
Where were they?
Well, they were, I think they were on Cary too, north. I think that house is there. You had a two-story square house on the east side of the street.
I think it's the Elliott house.
Probably is. I think that's it.
Here, wait, this isn't cool now.
It's going now.
Okay.
You wondered if they were more mature at that time. When we went over to John Knox's home there in Lee Summit, I met Alice Vogt. And she was a few years ahead of my time, but she knew my sister Edith real well, and Margaret knew she was there and took me to see her. We talked about the days when we were in college, you know. She says, the seniors were men then, she said. They weren't just kids.
Well, this, you know, literally.
And I think they were older, most of them.
Quite a few of them had been out. Mm-hmm. We've talked a surprising number of them who were out one or two or several years. I don't know about, well, someone like Henry. I don't know whether he was right out of high school or not when he was...
I don't know either. I don't suppose
Rowena's
he did.
Rowena's dad, see, he was...
But a lot of them were
older. 30 before he came off the farm, and Ray Cullen and some of those guys were quite a little older.
And there was Estelle Jones and...
We saw him, incidentally. We talked to Estelle Jones.
Herb Hoffman... Mishler, those fellows were, we thought they were men, but someone said that they never looked quite so important to anybody as they do to a freshman.
Yeah, that's right. Did you know George Watkins?
Yes.
We saw him, too, down in Arlington, Texas.
Yeah. Thing that's affected me as much as anything was the year of 1918 during the flu, when we were so full of sick people. I think at one time there were only 20 well people in the dormitory to take care of the sick people and do the cooking and the laundry, and we were pretty busy, and a matron got sick on our floor, and she sent for J.J., and he came over, and she told him to put me in charge of that dormitory. And I was still in the academy.
Is that right?
But it worked us all. But the people on the hill were scared to death of us, you know, and they were afraid to come near.
Well, did the people around town not have as much flu as others?
Oh, it was all over town, of course, but I think it was thicker there at the dormitory, and Dr. Heason would come out and say, you've got the flu, and there was just certain things we did, and he never showed up anymore, just to tell us what it was, and we knew just certain things to do and not do. And
well, I guess there were enough people dying at that time from flu.
There was one student died. Carrie Hardy. And she had told her roommate that she knew if she got it, it would take her because she had a bad heart. And we had a trained nurse on her from the hospital right away, but we couldn't save her.
Now, was she any of these? She wasn't a Missouri Hardy.
Yes, I think she came from Kansas City.
You had some Hardys from over there. Well, let's see. I don't know what other things we
ought
to do.
I think I said it. Stay real sick?
Yeah.
Oh, 2 or 3 weeks. Or a couple
it,
of weeks.
Was
so
it a high fever situation?
Most of them weren't really very sick, but a lot of them got pretty high fever. And there was one girl there from Idaho. Don't know if what we did, it was the wrong thing. You know, she just couldn't have a tepid bath to take down the fever because it would make her ears ache. She'd get a little cold, it'd get earache. And she just reacted wrong to everything it was done for.
Well, I remember my dad, or my folks talking about my dad helping to dig one of 7 graves in North English, Iowa, one day. Mm-hmm. It's a little town, you know, less than 1,000 people. The next day he got the flu, you know, that kind of stuff.
That was a terrible flu there, you know, those years. I know a nurse told me there at Lawrence about she worked in an army camp. You know, but it was right there.
I suppose they lost a lot of them in the camp.
Oh, yes.
You know the people at Lone Star told us that?
We're talking. We just went down to John Daggett's and got water.
Oh, wow.